Pack my bags. Last night, pre-flight, 0 hour, 9 a.m.
Welcome to Stupid Not Stupid. I'm Matt, here with my man Jason, the co-host responsible for the sudden rush of billionaires attempting to leave the planet.
If only that were true.
Jason, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. How about you, man?
Good. We are on track. Well, I guess we'll see how long it takes us to edit this and put it out, but we're like on a pretty decent cadence. We're like back within 1 week.
I know. It's sort of shocking.
Yeah, it's good. All right. Well, for anyone who's not aware of our delinquency, maybe we should do a quick format check. I think it's been like 5 or 6 episodes since we've done one. As always, I'll give you the opportunity to explain the format of the show, let you make some comment about how you don't do any work or contribute in any way, and then I'll have to do it.
Right. Well, I think you actually just gave the format of the show. Right.
So every week we get a topic. Either, I don't know, Jason and I come up with one, someone sends us one, or I don't know.
Yeah, whatever is the easiest path to a topic,
right,
is how we take.
The path of least resistance. And we essentially argue if it's stupid or not stupid. Generally, we make a decision. Rarely, we agree.
That's right. And again, you know, this all started in a garage before we had podcasting capabilities.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic hit and we just took all of our nonsense and gave it to you.
And the irony
the
is,
listener.
The irony is, we're now back in a garage, except with podcasting capabilities.
That's right.
Well, the other thing we do with each episode is plug the drinks that we have. I'm going to guess. Do you not have a flying dog over there for
I
once?
I do not. For the first time in like 9 episodes.
All right. Jason, you go first then.
All right. So I have got a Dogfish Head 60-minute IPA. I prefer the 90-minute or the 120-minute, though I just saw the 120-minute at a store the other day. It was like $45 for a six-pack, which is insane. Anyhow.
We need to do a supply chain episode.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. In my humble opinion, there are a lot of IPAs out there that I really love. I don't think that any of them are any better than anything that Dogfish Head does. So I'm very happy about that. And then for my second drink, I'm drinking some actually, you know what this is because you poured it for me.
Yeah, this is the Angel's Envy Reserve, courtesy of Dr. Andrew. So that's what I've got, too.
It's quite tasty.
Yeah. And then I'm also curious, you think 60, 90, or 120, which one of those IPAs in terms of the minutes is it going to take us to get through this episode this week?
I wish that they made like a 240 minute.
I don't think our listeners wish that, but we'll see. So speaking of our topic for this week, Jason, this is one that's been on the list for a while.
I think a year.
Yeah. I wonder if we've just been waiting for the moment we were just like too tired or too lazy to do something else because we knew we wouldn't have to do research for that one. And I am definitely, as people might be able to tell from my voice, at the point where I am too tired to do anything else. So we're finally rolling this one out.
Yeah. I think you've had like 4 hours of sleep a night for like 6 months.
Six months at least. Yeah. So here's the question, Jason. Mars, in our lifetimes, can we as a species get there? Stupid or not stupid. In our lifetimes, it can happen.
Right. First of all, the premise is stupid because we've already gotten there, right? We have robots all over Mars and surrounding Mars. And so
did Jason just self-identify as a robot?
No. I'm saying that as a species, we have.
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying as a fellow robot, you feel
right.
like
yes.
your brethren are already on Mars.
No, I think we covered that with the Dr. Newton episode. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Very much. I for one, welcome our artificial intelligent overlords. Yeah.
What is the thing like Mars is the only known planet entirely populated by robots?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So I think that specifically what we're talking about here is whether or not human beings in the flesh will actually step foot on Mars in our lifetimes.
So that's the first part of it. And I think the other part we need to definitively define is a time period because not everyone's lifetime is the same.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. Mine's like 3 to 4 years, and you're probably, you know, you got like 60 or 80 ahead of you.
See, I was gonna say yours was way higher, just given like the biomechanic nature of your biology over there, because we just established, yeah,
just in this body, I will transfer to another.
Yeah. so far in what, like 3 or 4 episodes now, you've transferred your consciousness either through some sort of like paranormal activity,
right,
or just a pure download.
That's
through
right.
AI. So congratulations on your longevity, Jason. So what do we want to say here? 50 years?
So,
or like the lifetime of all people who are alive now. So do you want to do 50 years, or do you want to say, okay, let's say a child who's born today and give them 100 years?
So the metric that I have been going on for, I don't know, the past 15 or 20 years has been, could we get there by 2050? But I agree with you. I think that's actually short for this conversation. Mm-hmm. So let's say 2065, just as sure. a date
you,
to throw
you
out.
You and I could both live to 2065.
Sure.
I know you won the race. You're not going to live forever.
I'm not stupid, Lucius. No one lives forever. No one. But with advances in modern science, my high level of income, I mean, it's not crazy to think I can't live to be 245, maybe 300. Heck, I just read in the newspaper they put a pig heart in some guy from Russia. You know what? I mean, you know what that means?
No, I don't know what that means. I guess longer life.
Well, no, he didn't live.
Oh, he didn't live.
No.
Oh.
It's just exciting that we're trying things like that.
Yeah.
All right, so 2060, is that what we're saying?
Sure, that's fine.
So 40 years from now, okay.
Yeah, there will definitely be people who will live longer than that, but just as a median to shoot for, let's go with 2060.
2060, okay. And then there's one other thing I want to knock out then before we start digging into the science of this, and this is what, I think we've defined before, I mean, we have a pretty uneducated and politically conservative audience, we've established that, but for any of the eye roll liberals who are listening, and you're my people, so don't have your feelings hurt, the question that inevitably gets asked when you have these kind of discussions is, why are we spending money in space, Jason? Don't we have problems here on Earth we need to fix?
Right.
So can we just get that out of the way now? Do you have a response to that?
I have several responses okay. to that. We'll start with the bumper sticker response, which is really simple. Not $1 spent on space has ever been spent in space. It's all money that's spent on Earth anyways. So it is providing jobs. It is providing high-level jobs to a highly educated workforce. It creates capabilities, knowledge, and technologies and scientific understanding that spreads into fields that are far beyond, you know, just space science.
And of course, all of that will change when Bezos opens his first space casino.
Right.
But we're just waiting
exactly.
for that to happen.
Then you don't need a master's degree to be working in space. Then,
just good people
then
skills.
Dr. Andrew can start. Yeah. But more than that, it's a false equivalency, right? This idea that every dollar we spend in space, we're not spending on Earth. That's simply not true. These are all choice. We are a very wealthy nation, and as a planet, you know, we choose to spend money in different ways in different countries, different cultures. But the United States has always spent money on science and technology in a myriad of fields. The question of whether or not we should be spending this much money in space is a question that I think we've answered for 70 years. Like, it's very clear that the society at large is okay with spending this money. But the argument that we could be spending this money more effectively on other problems is simply not true. It's we have chosen to spend money in the ways that we've chosen to spend it. We could choose to spend money very, very differently. It's not a lack of finance that is our problem. It's a lack of prioritization. And I would argue that we could, frankly, feed homeless people, educate everyone, and still do space exploration if we chose to do so.
If you just decided to do it.
Right.
I'll also make one other point on this, and I know you're going to hate it because I know you hate this thing, but every year NASA puts out like the book.
Right.
Right. The book of this is the money we spent and this is the amount of wealth it created. And it's like a 3-to-1 multiplier.
It's the spinoff technologies publication that they put out every year.
Yeah. And that basically makes the case like, look, you invested $1 in NASA and here's the $3 we gave you back.
Right. The problem with it's not that I hate the concept. The problem is that those numbers are skewed in such a way that they don't account for all of the development costs, all of the money that we put in. And as a result, it gives you an incorrect vision that for every dollar that you put into NASA, you know, industry receives or, you know, the United States receives $7 or $8 or $9, whatever. there's not really a good economic model to determine all of that. But the one thing I can absolutely assure you is any spin-off technology that you develop for space costs a whole lot more than the commensurate technology if you had developed it for Earth applications. So there is no $1 to $3 return on investment in space on 95% of space activities. Every now and again, you run into one that is great, but that's not the reason to do this.
Okay, last exercise before we close this part of the discussion and get to the real topic. You're going to be better at this than I do, so I'm just going to throw it at you.
Sure.
Shoot back to me the technologies that we use in our everyday life that have been developed as a result of something totally unrelated that we were doing in space. So I'm thinking off the top of my head, cordless power tools. That's space station to a degree.
It's sort of 2 degrees removed. But rechargeable battery technology.
Yeah. Velcro.
Yeah. despite the fact that, yeah, it probably caused the Apollo 1 fire.
Yep.
No, I would say
Jason, it didn't cause the fire. It accelerated it.
It accelerated it because of the high pressure, high oxygen environment. Yeah. More recent technologies, everyone who has a camera on their cell phone, that technology, the CCD technology, the all of that originated with the Mars program. It was accelerated through the intelligence program and the intelligence space observation program.
So James Bond could have a camera on his watch back when that was cool.
right. Yeah. No, but it basically all started with the Viking program in the 70s with Mars. But even more than that, like the software compression technology that allows you to take those photographs and they don't eat up every single piece of memory on your phone. It was the result of NASA trying to figure out how to get vast amounts of data back to Earth on a really, really weak radio channel. And you had to be able to compress that technology. So we figured out how to make spacecraft that could compress it at Mars, send a much smaller signal back, and then you could unzip it basically at Earth. All of that originated with the space program.
I think MRIs are on there too.
Yep,
aren't they? MRI imaging technology, and then the one that's not—that's really sad. It's an urban legend, Tang.
Yeah.
Tang is not on there.
No. There was a thing that went around the internet back in the 90s. I think it's still bouncing around. You know, the idea that the United States had invested all of this money on a pen that you could write in zero gravity.
And the Russians sent a
Russians
pencil.
The Russians used a pencil.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that was supposed to be this joke about how the U.S. just wastes money. In fact, NASA didn't develop that pen. That pen was developed by an independent private sector company, and they sold it to NASA. That is actually a great story of American capitalism at work. And, you know, they sold it to NASA.
I guarantee you there was some member of Congress that represented the district where the pen was manufactured and then wrote into the appropriates bill, you must purchase pens from like this geographic area.
Well, here was the thing. NASA actually paid almost nothing for those pens because what the company did was they said, look, if you use our pens, all we want is the right to advertise that you use our pens.
Oh, okay.
And they made a ton of money selling space pens to everybody who wanted a piece of the space, you know, memorabilia thing. NASA got a great deal out of that. This is capitalism. This is a public-private partnership that actually really worked.
And this is why we run the race to the moon.
That's right.
Well, speaking of that, then, let's get the journey to Mars started. So if we're going to get there by 2060, I think the first thing we have to understand is how far have we gone in space, Jason? And there are two elements to that, because there's how far, I guess, from a distance perspective, do we want to hold on? What's the unit of measurement we want to use? AUs, kilometers? Like, do you just want to use planets or the moon as a landmark? Is that the best way? Okay, so we'll use landmarks. I don't know if land counts.
Right.
We'll use astromarkers.
And I'm trying to remember, the moon is, and I haven't looked this up in a very long time, it's roughly 180 million miles from Earth.
I know it took 3 days.
Yeah, it's about a 3-day journey.
Yeah. So, well, all relative. Yeah,
exactly. But, yeah. Fodder for our We're Stupid,
stupid edition.
Yeah,
here we come. We're going to discuss this again. Okay, so we need to cover the actual distance, but also the amount of time that people are capable right. of being in an environment outside of the atmosphere yeah. of Earth. So,
and both of these things become relevant as we discuss the technology to get to Mars mm-hmm. further down. So the answer to your first question, how far, like distance-wise, have people gone in space? The moon is the furthest we have ever gone.
Let's go back to Lost Cosmonauts, Jason. It's the furthest we know we've ever gone.
It's the furthest that living people have ever gone.
They could have been alive as they floated past the moon. Catch our Lost Cosmonauts episode if you don't know what we're talking about, and you'll get caught up.
Again, I don't think that was actually a thing.
Our listeners disagreed, but go on,
fair
Jason.
documented, as far as we know at the moment, the furthest we've ever gone is the moon. And not even all that far on the moon, because it's always been on the side of the moon facing the Earth. So there is no quote-unquote dark side of the moon. There's the far side of the moon, but we have never sent people there. In fact, we had never sent spacecraft on the surface of the moon there until China did it about a year ago. So our distance away from Earth in the scope of the solar system, much less the galaxy, is actually very, very small.
Okay. And what about in terms of time? And I think what we have to focus in on here is time spent outside of Earth's orbit, because the Earth's magnetic field plays a pretty big role in how long, when you think about astronauts in the International Space Station, how long they're able to stay at the internet, stay in space.
Right.
So what's at play there?
So when we're talking about duration, you very, very correctly identified this idea of where were you in terms of the duration that you spent in space. If you are inside of the Van Allen belts, you are significantly protected from galactic radiation, which is a huge benefit as far as space travel goes, because galactic radiation is really, really dangerous.
This is what you see when you see the Northern Lights, right? It's radiation being reflected off the Van Allen belt. Is that right?
That's solar radiation primarily. Galactic radiation is both solar and extra solar system radiation emanating from the Big Bang or supernova or lots of other phenomena that are sending incredibly high charged particles through space that without an atmosphere, without a magnetic field, man, they just travel forever. Like they don't lose any energy. There is no friction to slow them down. So if you're within the Van Allen belts, anything inside of the Van Allen belts, and I'm using some loose terminology here, is basically low Earth orbit. Anything within the Van Allen belt is generally considered medium Earth orbit, and anything outside of the Van Allen belts is considered high Earth orbit.
So inside those three tiers, where's the International Space Station?
It's in low Earth orbit.
Low Earth orbit. Yes. So the safest possible space you could be in and still be in space.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And people have spent, and basically any space station, any extended stay in microgravity, which is not zero gravity because you're still close enough to the Earth that there is a small amount of gravity, but it's for all effects and purposes, zero G. Any extended space stay, anything more than a week and a half, has been in low Earth orbit, also known as LEO, because everything is
an acronym,
a TLA, yeah. Three-letter acronym.
Yeah. God.
Oh, there are a lot more space jokes coming, I promise.
Okay, so then I guess the important piece to take away from that is that we haven't gone that far,
right?
And we haven't been outside of the protection of the Van Allen belt or the Earth's magnetic field for more than couple weeks, not even.
If that. So, talking about like the longest stay at the moon is the longest that we've been outside of the Van Allen belts as any human mm-hmm. has been outside of the Van Allen belts. And my recollection was the last Apollo 17, I don't think it was a 2-week mission, maybe close to 2 weeks. I don't recall.
And so how long then, if we're looking at with current technology, how long to get to Mars then?
6 months.
6 months. Just factors of magnitude, more time exposed to...
Either exposed or you have to bring a tremendous amount of shielding.
Okay. All right. Now, some people then, their mind might be naturally going here to, what's the astronaut's name who spent a year?
Kelly. Yeah. I can't remember if it was Mark or his brother.
Astronaut Kelly.
Yes. Yeah. The twins. Yeah.
The twins. Yeah. So the astronaut who spent a year in space, he was in the most protected environment possible in terms of natural protection.
Correct.
And he still faced some detrimental health effects upon his return.
Yeah. And he did well because of lessons that we'd learned from Russian and Soviet cosmonauts who had spent even more time.
Oh, are these the ones that I've been getting those like emails about? Like, are cosmonauts stranded at the space station? If I just send $10,000 through to a bank account, they'll be able to retrieve him, and then he'll split his 3 years of back pay.
Right.
Yeah.
No, so the record holders for most time in space, I believe, are still Russian cosmonauts. They weren't Soviet, because I think that the Russians have since had people that stayed longer. The United States tends to be more conservative in both their engineering for astronauts and their mission planning for astronauts. So the fact that whichever Kelly brother it was stayed for a year, that was years after the Russians had kept somebody in space for over a year. And I think there have been a number of cosmonauts who have actually done that. What is interesting is that what we learned from those cosmonauts is when they came back, the amount of bone degradation, the amount of muscle degradation, the amount of ocular, you know, eye degradation was pretty extreme. And these people ended up basically in traction for 6 months, rebuilding themselves in order to be able to function. And by the time that Mark Kelly came back, or I think it was Mark, I'm not, again, we'll figure that out later. By the time he came back, he was able to stand very briefly when he first returned, but then only spent like 5 to 6 weeks before he was able to walk on his own. But it still took him months or years to recover from all of those degenerative issues. And the real question is, you know, what is the long-term impact? Did he ever recover to 100%? And we're still not really entirely certain.
All right, so that's where we've been. So let's talk about where we're going, Jason. And that's to Mars. We're going to...
Get your ass to Mars.
Yeah. Yeah. So how far, if we wanted to go to Mars tomorrow, Jason, with our current technology, how far could we get? So let's say we got to get there by 2060. We have what we have right now.
Yes. As of today.
As of today. So let's look at it this way. Like, there is a life or death question. Like, there is some existential threat that we identify to humanity, and the only way to save the human species is we have to get to Mars in the next 3 years to save humanity.
Okay, that's different. 3 years is different than today.
Okay, let's say 2 years then.
Okay.
So I think 2 years constitutes as, like, we find out there's a threat. The only thing we can do to save humanity is to get to Mars in the next 2 years. So we have to use current technology.
Yeah.
Why couldn't we? What are the barriers right now with the technology we currently have in terms of getting to Mars?
Yeah, we'd be fucked. And the reason
is that your scientific analysis?
It is. It's my program analysis.
Yeah.
The reason is we don't have...
Is that the memo line that you send when they ask you this question?
Yes. Yeah.
Free memo. Yes. We are fucked.
All caps.
Yeah.
Three different colors. Yeah. No, the reason is right now we don't have a lift vehicle that is capable of launching the crew capsules and the equipment that you need to keep people alive for 6 months. We don't have a lift vehicle capable of getting that much mass to orbit and on its way to Mars available right now. We just don't have one. And we haven't for a very, very long time. The last thing that we had that might have been able to do that would have been the Apollo 11. And we haven't had anything with that lift capability since. You know, people remember the space shuttle as being this really amazing spacecraft. And it was great. But it could only get to basically low Earth orbit. If you really, really juiced it, you could get as high as like the Hubble Space Telescope, which is in medium Earth orbit. But that was it. Like, there was no chance that thing was getting to the moon, much less to Mars, because it weighed so much in order to be able to come back to Earth and land like an airplane. All of that mass requires extra fuel. As an advisor of mine in grad school used to say, the rocket equation's a real bitch.
Yep. Just to be clear for the listeners, the problem with the rocket equation is, what do you need to lift more mass? More fuel. What does fuel have? More mass.
That's
what do you need to lift more mass? More fuel.
That's right. Yeah. And it becomes a circular and ever more difficult equation.
Yeah.
And it's all based on the Earth's gravity well. That is a non-negotiable factor.
So we can't lift it. So that's problem one. Say we could lift it.
Yes.
What becomes the next problem? So we lift it. We're in low Earth orbit. We point at where, not where Mars is, but where Mars is going to be when
where
we get there.
Where it's going to be. Right.
Where it's going to be when we get there, and we hit the engines.
Okay.
What's our next problem?
Assuming that the orbital dynamics work out in such a way that, so the way that Earth and Mars rotate around the sun, the optimal launch period happens about once every 18 months. That's when you can launch from the Earth and get to Mars with the least amount of energy expended. If you launch in the middle of that period, like so if you assume that 18 months is the optimal period. If you launch 9 months into that, the amount of energy that you have to use is almost four times as much as it would be to launch on the optimal period. So it's just, we have nothing even remotely approaching being capable of doing that. So you're really constrained by this 18-month cycle. So assuming that you're able to launch during that period, the other thing that you have to have is, and assuming that you've got the launch vehicle that's capable of sending you on that trajectory, you now have to have something that keeps astronauts or cosmonauts or taikonauts or whoever's going alive for that 6 to 6.5 month journey.
I like to think that the knots that will go to Mars for the first time will be citizens of micronations. Again, catch the micronations episode if you haven't heard it, listeners.
Having grown up as a kid in the 1970s and having been fascinated by the toys, like I actually embarrassingly have a collection of them to this day, I love the idea of them being called micronauts.
Micronauts. Before you give us some of the additional things that are going to kill us on our way to Mars.
Oh, and the list is long. Yes.
Just on the launch windows that you talked about now, between now, 2021,
right,
and 2060, when we need to get there by for the purposes of this question, there is a key year that's going to fall between those, 2033.
That's
what's
correct.
Interesting about 2033, and shout out to our boy, Congressman Ed Perlmutter, who I know listens.
Yes. So 2033 is through a series of galactic occurrences, well, solar system occurrences. 2033 is a sort of once in a generation, maybe once in a five generation accumulation of useful factors that make it the best launch opportunity to get to Mars. It is the least energy required to get to Mars, which also means the least energy required to slow down once you get there. Because this is the other thing that people often forget about. It takes a lot of energy to leave Earth's gravity well and head towards Mars, get on the trajectory,
you bring all that energy with you.
That's right. You're still traveling at an insane amount of speed, and to enter Earth or to enter Mars orbit, or even just to go, it takes less energy to enter Mars orbit. But if you want to go directly to the landing, you have to basically counteract all of the energy that it took to get out of Earth's atmosphere and out of Earth's orbit. That's a whole lot of energy. And you're going at this tremendous speed. So you basically, halfway there, have to turn the spacecraft around and fire up those engines again to slow yourself down or figure out another way to do it. And there are multiple ways of doing that, and we'll get into those. But that's a huge part of this calculation in determining when is the best time to launch. And 2033 requires the least amount of energy to get going and the least amount of energy to slow down to get there, probably in the next 150 years, maybe even longer than that. I don't remember what the dynamic was, but it's literally like a once in a, it's the one time in my lifetime that would be the most optimal to go to Mars.
So let's say that the Principality of Outer Baldovia, my favorite micronation,
right,
has its space program up and running and is ready to launch in 2033. we solve this problem of escaping the Earth's gravity well. You can solve any problem in space with a sentence that begins with "all you got to do is." So let's say the Principality of Outer Baldovia has it figured out. We get our micronauts into space. We escape Earth's gravity and we're heading for Mars. What's the next thing that's going to kill the micronauts?
That would be the radiation.
The radiation.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the problem with the radiation, Jason?
So you're talking about really high powered particles and waves. Amazingly high particles, high powered stuff that is eating away at your DNA. So in the short term, your big problem is just dying outright of radiation poisoning,
mm-hmm,
which means that you just throw up and have diarrhea until all of your cells break down and you turn into a puddle of ooze. Even if you don't encounter that, the chances are that it will damage your DNA to a degree that you're not going to survive without massive cancer within 5, 10, maybe 15 years.
Have you read Project Hail Mary yet?
No, I have not.
No, there's a great plot twist related to this. So anyone who's read Andy Weir's new book, Project Hail Mary, what happens with the plot twist related to radiation? This is exactly what Jason's talking about. I'm trying to do no spoilers because I want Jason to read the book. Yeah.
Right. But having grown up in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, I'm very well aware of what radiation poisoning does. All of that said, so radiation poisoning is your big concern.
I want to throw this one at you. Tell me if you think this is, I can't remember where I read this. This is one of the solutions I've heard proposed to the radiation problem.
Yeah.
Is create a spacecraft with a hollow outer shell. So basically an empty cavity.
Yep.
And you pump the human waste into the cavity.
That's exactly right.
And that supposedly creates a pretty effective shield.
It's astonishingly effective. And the reason for that is the best shield against radiation in space, aside from lead, which you can't launch because it's cost prohibitive, is water. And human waste is 95% water. So rather than transferring all of that water that humans are going to drink and then turn into waste that you're just going to evacuate, and then having also all of that water as a shield, why not just double dip, as it were?
Yeah. So you just need to do the liquefied bean burritos in the food tubes, and you'll just fill that shield right up.
That's right. But the issue with that is how much of that shield can you fill before the radiation becomes
a
problem.
And then how much water have you taken out of your water cycle, because you're
That's
drinking,
right.
you're sustaining yourself off your waste.
Right.
Also.
It's sort of like the rocket
water
equation.
The water that you have is the water you brought with you. Your
That's
body's
right.
not manufacturing
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Right.
There is no Dasani in space. Right. Yeah. So the consideration there from an engineering standpoint is you bring enough water to sustain the humans all the way to the surface of Mars. At which point, theoretically, and we'll get into this later, you can melt water ice at Mars. But you can either bring just the amount of water that you need to sustain the humans along the trip and use their waste as shielding, or you launch both the water required for shielding and have the humans drink it as they go. So you're either slowly adding to the shielding or you're slowly depleting the shielding. Neither of those are optimal.
Okay. All right. Well, all right. The Micronauts are up. They've pooped into the hole.
Right.
They're shielded from radiation.
And let's hope that their bathrooms work better than the SpaceX bathrooms.
Yeah. I just read about that. Yeah. I love how they always find these crazy turns of phrases. So when the SpaceX rocket blows up, it's a rapid unscheduled disassembly.
Oh, that's a term that dates back to the 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when the
RUD event.
Yeah. When the toilet stopped working on the SpaceX vehicle. The thing they posted today was the astronauts were using non-reusable emergency garments.
Right.
Or
yeah.
Something.
which basically means
diaper.
Yeah, poop your pants.
Yeah. all right. So we're behind the poop shield. Are we going to make it to Mars?
At that point, so if you've got shielding and you've got propellant, and again, so we should also look at one other technology while we're discussing this. It doesn't all have to be chemical rockets. So there's been a lot of development done in the past 20, 30 years on what's known as solar electric propulsion.
SEP. Use your acronyms, Jason.
Sorry. The SEP, yes. which uses electricity generated by solar panels to power what's known as an electric motor. An electric motor uses a chargeable gas to create ions, an electrically charged version of this gas that at a very slow rate is expelled. And by electrically charging the gas, you gain a really small amount of thrust. But over time, because you're in, like I said, a frictionless environment, that really small amount of thrust increases linearly over a long period of time. It was an inventive idea that's been around for 30 or 40 years. It's now coming into the realm of possibility, and it's really kind of a technology that could change the way that we think about all of this. Because if you don't have to carry all of that, again, going back to the rocket equation.
Carry the engine.
Right. So getting really in the weeds on this. When you think about fuel efficiency of different rocket fuels, it's known as specific impulse. That's the measure that you use. Capital I, little sp. So in the rocket community, it's called ISP. It's specific impulse is what they're talking about. It's basically, what's more fuel efficient? It's like gasoline versus diesel versus electric motors.
Kerosene, if you're in the Soviet Union.
Right, right. And what you see is that, because kerosene is used as a rocket fuel as well, kerosene and oxygen has a very low ISP. It's super cheap, but it has a very low ISP. So you need a lot of it Kerosene rockets are not particularly good at moving mass, and they're, you know, they're very inefficient. Up to this point, the highest ISP that we've really dealt with for rockets has been liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. The ISP compared to kerosene and oxygen is huge, and particularly frozen, you know, it's like an order of magnitude better.
This is why you see like the, it looks like dry ice coming off the rocket before it launches, right? Right.
Well, yeah. Exactly. And it's mostly liquid oxygen because that's your oxidizer. But when you look at something like a solar electric propulsion, you're using like argon as your propellant. The ISP on this stuff is insane. It's like orders of magnitude better than liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. It's just that the thrust is almost non-existent.
But in space, in a vacuum,
space, it doesn't matter.
In a vacuum, it doesn't matter.
It's like it's like having a Tesla or a Prius that is 10,000 times more fuel efficient than the average Chevy.
So you use the Chevy to get out of Earth's orbit,
right?
And then you use the Prius to get you to Mars.
That's right. And yeah, because you've got 6 months transfer time. If you're just slowly decelerating as you get to Mars, it costs you almost nothing. And the weight savings is huge. The energy savings is it's just massive. So it's a fascinating technology that I think is right on the cusp. But like, I think it's viable today. We just don't have an operating
one. In an emergency situation, we have to get there like by 2060. We could accelerate solar electric propulsion.
If we had to do this within the next 10 years, I think we could do solar electric propulsion on that because this is the other thing, is it's scalable in a way that most propulsion technologies are not. If you just add more SEP units, you know, if you've got one and you add a second one, you double your propulsion capability.
Right.
It's a linear increase in a way that is not true because of the rocket equation. You have to add more fuel, therefore you have more mass, therefore you need... Yeah, it's not that problem with SEP. And that technology, we haven't flown it on a human mission yet.
But
we
use it for
test.
Deep probes.
We have used it for deep probes. So we know it works and we know that it's scalable. So it's just it's an engineering problem. It's not a science issue.
So we know how we're going to be protected from radiation. We know how we're going to get there once we get out of orbit. So now I guess the next transit question I'm interested in is, I guess it's twofold. Communications and sanity. So the further we get from Earth, the longer.
Funny thing is, those aren't the biggest problems. Oh. But yes, let's go. let's start with those.
Okay, so communications and sanity. The further that we get from Earth, the longer the delay is in communications. And I think by the time you get to Mars, the net isn't it around like 13 minutes. So 26 minutes total. Like I say hi. 13 minutes later, you hear it. You say something back, and then 26 minutes later, I get your response.
Again, it depends on where Earth and Mars are in their orbits related to each other. It can be as low as like an 8-minute traverse either way.
But
it can
still
be as high as
significant.
Right.
So because
but you also have to keep in mind that because Earth and Mars both orbit on the elliptical, there is a portion of each year
they
where
can't communicate at all.
The sun is in between them and you can't talk to anybody.
Right.
Yeah.
So because of that situation, it's not like you can have Houston, we have a problem.
That's
if
right.
something goes wrong.
Right.
So you have to have either the human capacity on board to basically solve any problem or some sort of, going back, I think is our third reference to a previous episode, a really advanced artificial intelligence capability that can provide the interface to you that instead of Houston, I guess it's Watson, we have a problem.
Sure.
Do we have that capacity available to us now where the humans on a spacecraft without the capability to communicate back with Earth would have the capacity to rely on artificial intelligence to solve problems?
So I'm not sure that I would say that the artificial intelligence has reached that level yet. But what I have seen that was encouraging is actually on a different space mission. There's a heliophysics mission called, it's a robotic spacecraft called the Solar Parker Probe.
The fastest object ever created by mankind.
That's right.
Yeah.
And its mission is to fly as close to the sun as anything has ever gone before. And it's getting within like 3.5 million miles of the sun.
You and I have seen it. Like we've touched
the
panels. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an astonishing spacecraft. It's super, super cool. And again, it was something that it was on, you know, scientists' wish lists for 35 years before the technology caught up with it. But one of the issues with this thing is when you're flying that close to the sun, the amount of radiation
you can't communicate.
Yeah. and it will melt anything that's not covered by the heat shield.
Right.
So there was a really cool movie. The science was a little iffy, but the special effects were fantastic. It was a movie called Sunshine, done by Danny Boyle a number of years ago. They weren't wrong at all about the special effects. Like anything outside of a heat shield just gets vaporized. Well, this spacecraft has four antennae that trail behind it to communicate with Earth. But these antennae, when it's not within, you know, a specific heat range of the sun, these antennae expand outside of the scope of the heat shield in order to be able to transmit data. But you had to have protocol, like safety protocol, that if the spacecraft tilted slightly wrong in one direction or the other, you're far enough from the Earth, there was zero chance that you could get communications back and forth quickly enough
to fix it.
Right. So they had to create fault reconciliation software that was capable of doing that in real time under those kinds of extreme conditions. And this thing it's been flying around the sun for years now. And we're, as a matter of fact, I think last week, it just passed Venus on its way into its deepest
orbit
entry yet into the sun's coronosphere. Man, the thing is functioning flawlessly. And this was a huge question as to whether or not we were even capable of programming something to do that. So watching that fault tolerance in a robotic spacecraft makes me far more confident that you don't necessarily need AI to deal with fault tolerance.
You just need good programming.
You need to think through all of the different scenarios and have adaptive fault tolerance algorithms. The real problem there, though, is, I mean, you can recognize and solve all the problems on Earth or on your way to Mars, but if you don't have the equipment with you, it doesn't matter. Like, oh, well, all you need is a 10 millimeter screw to fix this. Well, we don't have any 10 millimeter screws. Well, you're done.
Well, that's where 3D printing comes in.
This is where I was going, isn't it? 3D printing, again, additive manufacturing is this technology that is fascinating and potentially capable of changing the way that we think about all of these things. But it's not there yet. We can do it pretty effectively on Earth in a lot of different ways. I have seen titanium additive manufacturing. It just blows my mind. But that equipment is massive. And like we flew a 3D printer to the ISS a couple of years ago. And what we found was that it was a very novelty project.
Right. It doesn't work in zero G.
That's right.
And so this gets back to another Project Hail Mary throwback. Everyone read the book. But the amount of mass required to be able to create the artificial gravity necessary to be able to operate a 3D printer is probably prohibitive of our launch capabilities.
Once again, the rocket equation
is a bitch. Yeah. Okay, so we can probably overcome I'm sorry, I don't want to say AI now because we've established it's not purely an AI problem, but the communications problem. There is
the fault redundancy issue.
Fault redundancy. We can figure it out. The best way or the easiest way to get someone there, to get our micronaut to Mars, is reduce mass. How do you reduce mass? You only send one.
Right.
Right? And so if you're the lone micronaut, are you going to go nuts, Jason? Are you going to go insane?
There has actually been a tremendous amount of work on this. And the problem is there's not a scientific corollary. We can only come up with scientific, suggestions, people who have done extreme environments.
There's Arctic people who've done, I've read books about guys who spent, seven, 8 months alone.
Right.
Buried in Antarctica, basically in an underground shelter.
Yeah, that's the closest analog that you can come to this. But those people weren't sent up, those people didn't end up in Antarctica expecting to be the only person alone, right? So it's not a one-to-one correlation. That said, this is a real concern. Even if you only send four people, NASA has done a lot of research in this over the past 30, 40 years. There are several books available publicly on NASA history websites, people talking about the research that's been done in this regard. It's a non-trivial issue. And it's not just about picking the right people, because there are so many variables that we don't understand. That kind of isolation is not something you can really model on Earth. And the few times that we've tried to model it, the biosphere experiments, hasn't gone particularly well.
The Pauly Shore one?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It doesn't work well. And it's usually because there's a breakdown in the biosphere itself. Like this idea, this is a huge issue that we have to deal with. So there are two possibilities. You send, at the moment, from a mission architecture standpoint, you send somebody to Mars for 6 months, they get there, they stay for 2 weeks and they immediately come back, or they're there for a year and a half and then they come back. There is no middle ground. There's no, you stay there for a month or you stay there for 6 months. Those are the options. Like because of the orbital dynamics that we were talking about, you're there for 2 weeks and you come back, or you're there for a year and a half and you come back. And in neither of those circumstances, is there any help? Like the moment that you launch, you are on your own. You have what you took with you. You have what's landed on the planet, and you have, you know, your wits. You know, you can communicate with NASA, but they can't do anything for you. Now, you know, if you choose the year and a half mission architecture, theoretically, they can get something to you in 6 months. Well, any problem that you have that you hadn't planned for that allows a 6 month lag, you know, the movie The Martian, or you know, Andy Weir's book The Martian, notwithstanding, is probably not survivable. That's going to be a real problem.
So, but the question, Jason, isn't necessarily could an individual person figure it out on their own agency, but would they have the mental faculties to be able to survive it? So, is it psychologically possible if, you know, dealing with the rocket equation is a bitch.
Right.
We can only send one.
Right.
Can one human being, I guess it varies from human to human, we'd have to pick the right person, or can anyone survive that kind of isolation?
And this is the issue, is I think that there are people who can, but I don't think that...
Thanks, Jason. I appreciate that. we both agree that I would survive, right?
One of us agrees with that. The real issue is I don't think that, in the same way that physical science has not figured out all of the issues that we need to confront in order for people to survive physically, I don't think psychology knows enough to be able to pick the right person. I think that there are enough intangibles. The person that you think would be perfect for this mission might go batty. The person that you thought there was no chance might be exactly the person that you need to send alone.
So, all right, we found a way to not go crazy. We picked a micronaut with the right stuff.
Sure.
We have a great Watson on board and fail-safe redundancies, so we're good there. We have SCP.
Right.
We've arrived at Mars. Is there another problem we have to solve before we figure out how the fuck we're going to land?
Yes, so there are several. First, you have to make sure that your spacecraft was not hit by any micrometeorites or any other unplanned factors that have crippled the ship or compromised.
Murphy's Law hasn't kicked in. That's essentially what we're counting on.
So assuming that we have the luck of the Irish, or in my experience, the exact opposite of the luck of the Irish. Exactly. If he didn't have bad luck, he'd have no luck at all. So you get there. You now need, like, you were either using solar electric propulsion to slow down, or you get there and you use a technique in which the spacecraft dips into the atmosphere slightly.
Like, quote-unquote, air brakes.
Yeah, that's the term is known as aerobraking.
Yeah.
So you get there and you use a heat shield that doesn't need to be as robust, but still, you know, dissipates a lot of energy. You've got all of this speed, all of this velocity. It's energy. That, you know, velocity in physics, as anyone has taken, you know, physics in high school knows, it's just a form of energy. If you're going to slow yourself down, that energy has to go somewhere because of... As we discussed, the, you know, first law of thermodynamics.
we're four episodes now we've linked. Yeah, because the atmosphere has mass, right? So energy hits mass,
right.
It collides, it's creates friction, slows
that's
down.
That's right.
Okay.
And the friction creates heat, and that's where the energy dissipates.
Right.
So if you dip into the atmosphere at a shallow enough level, you slow down, and you can even do it like once or twice in orbit or something, but you eventually end up in a relatively stable orbit around Mars. That's the most efficient, but
takes more time,
slowest way to do it.
And when you only have 2 weeks to play with.
Right. Yeah. You don't have a month and a half to get yourself into a stable orbit and then figure out how to get down to the surface. So that means you're going to come in really hot. And that means you need a massive heat shield. And the problem that we have now...
More mass.
Well, A, more mass.
Yeah.
And B, it has to dissipate a whole lot more energy. So you're dealing with temperatures much higher. And we have materials right now that are capable of dealing with those kinds of temperatures. If you're landing, say, 2 tons of mass on Mars at the Martian equator, or ideally even further north or south of the equator, and you want to land them in like a crater or a riverbed somewhere, because that gives you extra kilometers.
Sure.
Because once you get through with the heat shield, then, you know, there's the atmosphere on Mars is 1/100th of what it is on Earth. So incredibly thin carbon dioxide atmosphere, but it's enough of an atmosphere that a parachute has an effect. So once you get through, you know, the initial atmospheric shock, once you get down to, you know, I don't know, Mach 1.5, Mach 2, then you pop a parachute, which on Earth would completely destroy your craft. But because the atmosphere is so thin, that actually provides you enough friction to slow the spacecraft down that you can land, like I say, about 1.5 tons, 2 tons, maybe 3 at this point, maybe even 4. Let's go crazy. Let's say you could land 4 tons using the current systems that we have near the equator in a crater. What we need for a human spacecraft, even with one person, is somewhere on the order of 20 to 30 tons.
Right.
So literally an order of magnitude more than what we're capable of now. So how much shield...
How much of that can you solve, Jason? How much of that mass, and this might be too technical, but the obvious solution to that problem is you start launching shit beforehand. So sure. You pile up supply caches, all the stuff that takes up mass that you had to bring with you that added to that 20, 30 tons, you get it there before you.
No, this is assuming that you've already done it.
Okay.
Yeah. This is assuming that you have food cache, you have habitability already on the surface. Everything is already there that you need. This is just the amount of mass required to keep
life support.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oxygen and make sure that you don't die from freezing or heating, getting through the atmosphere, getting you to the surface without crushing your brain because of, you know, 100G shock waves. Like, that's what it takes to get a human being to the surface. Like, bare bones. It's probably around the neighborhood of 20 tons.
I think this might be the only one so far we don't have a solution for.
But the thing is, I'm actually relatively confident, like, we couldn't do it in the next 2 years, but by 2033, if we put our minds to it, we have solved all of the major, like, material sciences problems of this. At this point, it really is just an engineering challenge. It's not a science challenge.
So we keep saying this phrase that we keep coming back to. I feel like we've covered the journey to Mars here. But there's a phrase that we keep saying, Jason, and that phrase is, if we decided to do it.
Right.
So this brings up, I think, the most contemporarily interesting and classic question in this. And I'll try not to go too far into a history lesson here. But if we decide to do it, who is we? So are we talking here about, you know, the Principality of Outer Baldovia? Are we talking about NASA? Or are we talking about our bourgeoisie billionaire class?
Right.
That, you know, the hottest and newest thing to do is to play in space.
Yeah, the second Gilded Age.
The second Gilded Age, yeah. Right. So who's likely to pull it off? Is it our boys at Blue Origin? And that's a shout out to one of our listeners who I know is enjoying this episode. Is it going to be a private company or is it going to be a nation state if we had to decide to do it?
So again, we're talking about a time frame between now and 2060.
Right.
Which seems like a lot of time to most people. But when you're talking about space, even robotic missions, the missions that you see now, the Perseverance rovers on Mars, the New Horizons mission out at Pluto, the OSIRIS-REx mission that just took a sample of the asteroid Bennu and is coming back to Earth to bring that sample back, those missions took 20 to 30 years to get off the ground. And those are missions that cost single billions of dollars. What we're talking about is a mission, conservatively, no matter how much cost savings you look at from technological cutting of corners or technological innovation, like
taking the lowest bidder.
Exactly. Conservatively, you're talking anywhere from and I don't believe you could do it for 30, but I think anywhere from 30 to $75 billion for a completely bare bones mission. And from a government standpoint, you're never going to fly a bare bones mission. Because there aren't enough stakeholders. There's not enough of a coalition built to justify that kind of spending. That said, if you look at $30 billion, if you look at, you know, the robber barons of today, that's a significant portion of their wealth. Like, the Elon Musks of the world could almost go bankrupt trying to pursue this, and they don't have the resources of the entire federal government. There's an old joke in Washington, D.C., you know, how do you make a small fortune in space?
Start with a big one.
You start with a big one.
Yeah.
And I think that the Bezoses of the world, I think that the Bransons of the world, the Musks of the world are feeling that pinch, and you're starting to see them go after government contracts because they don't want to, like, they don't want to go all in on this potential pipe dream, because what we're talking about, you could spend $30 to $70 billion for one trip to Mars that you're there for 2 weeks, that's probably going to fail, and there is no sustainability. That's not what these guys are preaching, right? So we're at a point now where the richest people on Earth can't afford to do it on their own. So I think we're still at a state-level enterprise.
Okay. All right.
And that's my humble opinion. I know there are a lot of people who think differently, but I've been looking at this for 20 years.
Right.
At a professional level, the money just doesn't add up.
It's just an important point to make, because I think for people who will listen to this or just kind of like the armchair person who thinks it's cool and is interested and tracks it, they're like, oh, it's who cares about NASA? Elon Musk is going to get us to Mars. But when you start putting the levels of funding that we're talking about into perspective, it's even beyond, what did you call it, the robber baron class of 2021.
It's even beyond them. And I wish it weren't. I just want to get to Mars. Like, if they could do it, I don't care who does it. I don't have a dog in this fight. It doesn't matter to me if it's a government. It doesn't matter to me if it's NASA, if it's ESA, if it's JAXA, if it's a combination of the three, if it's
a micronation.
Elon Musk, if it's a micronation, that would actually be the best of all possibilities to me. But the fact of the matter is, these problems are incredibly difficult, and they require a level of investment that's just not sustainable from an individual level at the moment. Now, I will argue that the Blue Origins and the SpaceXs, to a lesser degree, the Virgin Galactics of the world, are bringing those costs down. But it's not a snap of the fingers. It's not an overnight success. It's going to be 20 or 30 years before those advances are really recognized, are really valued correctly, that those those businesses become stable enough and access to space, the cost comes down in price to a degree where we can start talking about what the next step is. And Mars is like five steps from here. So this idea that because SpaceX lowered the costs from, you know, the United Launch Alliance costs for expendable launch vehicles by a significant degree, I mean, access to low Earth orbit is much cheaper than it used to be. And that's certainly opened up a huge amount of trade space for commercial space activities. That has nothing to do with getting us to Mars. That is a whole different conversation. I keep using this term orders of magnitude. That's like five orders of magnitude away from getting us to Mars.
The only place where it could be useful is if you were going to, and this is one of the other solutions that we haven't touched on yet, is if you were going to assemble your craft in space. So instead of like one massive launch where you've got to figure out the rocket equation to get some huge amount of mass up there, you do a bunch of small ones. And that is the problem that they have theoretically solved if you had to do it that way. Now, the technology to assemble it in space, I don't know if that exists.
Again, it's one of those, all you got to do is dot, dot, dot.
Right.
Like, so first of all, we haven't gotten there yet. Like the costs of expendable launch vehicles or reusable launch vehicles, in the case of SpaceX, we're not there yet. Like the costs have come down, but you know, the launch manifest for SpaceX last year, I think, was in the neighborhood of 30 or 35 launches. Blue Origin isn't launching yet. ULA was in the neighborhood of 30 to 40, but all of ULA's launches are paid for by the government. You would need, in order to do on-orbit construction, on-orbit servicing, you would need hundreds of launches per year by multiple companies. And that's not something that's going to happen in the next 5 years. And anyone who tells you that it is clearly angling for you to invest in their company. They don't actually believe it themselves.
So I think now we're at reference three to the Project Hail Mary novel. But is it something that could happen in an existential threat situation? So if we had to marshal resources as a species, and all of those companies that you just talked about, in addition to governments, had to rally together, it is something that as a species we could do if given no other choice.
I actually don't think that that's the case.
That's depressing.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's not just you throw money at the problem and everybody works triple shifts. Like, it's a matter of construction infrastructure. There aren't enough clean rooms. There aren't enough facilities to build these things at a faster rate than they're already building them. There are, you know, China is working on turning this kind of stuff into industrial level capacity. The US is looking at more varieties of launch options than economies of scale by building the same kind of thing that gets you the same amount of capacity into orbit over and over again. China is far more interested in building this concept of like a universal bus and a universal launch vehicle so that you just plug an instrument in and launch it. The problem is the United States tried that for 35 years and was never able to realize it because no two missions are the same and technology evolves quickly enough that those markets disappear really quick.
Well, the one nation you left out was obviously the Principality of Outer Baldovia, who has got it figured out, Jason, so so have some faith.
Yeah, so as soon as they come up with, you know, 120...
all you have to do is...
......
All right, last question here. Well, I guess not last question, but maybe last question before we get to the definitive ask is, and I feel like maybe in a way, this is what we've already been talking about without explicitly saying it, but this got big with the whole Mars One movement a couple years ago.
Yeah.
What if we just had to get someone there and we just had to get them there?
Right.
Like, what if the solution to whatever the existential threat is that we're trying to solve in this scenario, that's we got to just land a person on the surface so they can, you know, Bruce Willis push the button to blow Mars up to save us all. What if it's a one-way trip?
Yeah. First of all, it's very difficult for me to imagine a scenario in which that was the answer. Like, what is the problem that that's the answer to?
Because, Jason, it just is the problem, okay?
Right. Again, the real issue there is if you send one person, or if you send four people for that matter, even if you send all of the equipment and all of the fuel and all of the habitat, all of that stuff gets there first. Right now, we don't have the ability for all of that to get set up autonomously. That's easily billions of dollars of tens of billions of dollars of research, probably hundreds of billions of dollars of research to make it happen, and minimum a 30-year project just to figure out how to set up the habitat so that when the astronauts or micronauts or cosmonauts or land, that they just walk into the house and they're good. So what that means is when you get there, the minute you hit the surface, you need to figure out shelter, you need to figure out food, and you need to do it quick because the surface of Mars is highly irradiated.
Right. But I'm saying eliminate those problems from, like, this person knows they're going there to die. I'm saying we could get it human there.
But here's my problem. They land there after 6 months of traversing that distance. They're going to get there. They land into 1/3 Earth gravity, which is what the gravity is.
They're going to face the same problem that Kelly faced, but without the infrastructure to recover.
They can't stand up. They can't see. And they're probably suffering from some form of sickness, like radiation sickness. So they're not going to be able to crawl from their landing capsule to the lava tube with the water and the food, much less set up the structure that they're going to need within, you know, 6 to 8 hours. They're not going to be able to do it within 6 weeks.
So this one is all you have to do is just die.
Right. No, that's the thing is we could probably get somebody to the surface of Mars in those circumstances, and they would get there and go, I made it, and then die.
So, Jason, I think you just answered my next question. Stupid or not stupid, we could get a human to the surface of Mars by 2060. Not stupid.
It's not stupid.
Yeah, we could do it.
Right. Why?
Like I said, to avoid whatever the counterfactual apocalyptic scenario is.
That aliens had put some red button on the surface of Mars that we had to push in order to save the Earth. And, you know, we could send one person and all they had to do was land next to that button and push it before they died.
Right.
Yeah.
That's, like I said, a Bruce Willis blow the asteroid moment. That's what I'm trying to manufacture here.
Yes. Aside from the entire stupidity of that scenario, given those constraints, yes, it's not stupid.
Somewhere Aaron Campbell is rolling his eyes because he's pointing out that I have made an argument that specifically is crafted to fit the answer I had before I proposed the question.
Right. Yeah. Yes, it's the perfect logical but non-scientific argument to make.
That's what I specialize in.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Rhetorical.
Do you got anything else on this one?
Again, man, I hate to be the naysayer on this because I got into all of this stuff, you know, 20, 25 years ago because I really wanted to see humans land on Mars. And I have been doing this kind of stuff professionally now for a very, very long time. And the more I do it and the more that I'm involved in it, the more I'm convinced that I will not see people land on Mars in my lifetime. I hope, and I think this is an offhand chance, I really hope that I see people orbit Mars in my lifetime.
Okay, maybe that's the question we should have asked, but we'll save that. We'll like wait like 2 years when this episode's like buried in the in our episode list that no one can find it or get to it. We'll do humans orbiting Mars.
Yeah. I think from now on, like annually, we should do a post-Halloween episode that's all about...
All about Mars? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, at least we'll be committed to getting it done then. So,
that's right.
Yeah. I think the last thing to do is just basically encourage all of you listening to this, you know, haul out a space between your walls, take a giant shit into it, and hopefully that'll shield you from the radiation of this episode. Until next week.